Isn't it fun technology? Only that wasn't really high tech. That was just a battery issue. I think I'm going to come to be known as the rabbi of many mics. But then again, my name is John, so I don't know how that works. A number of years ago, as part of an ad campaign to sell cigarettes, so you know that's a long number of years ago, a certain phrase became quite popular. You've come a long way, baby. Now, it was meant to remind women of how far they had come along the road to equality. Quick pause. Oh boy, did that they get that one mixed up. But anyhow, it was obviously intended to sell more cigarettes to women. And the pitch was they could now smoke like men. Oh, and by the way, die of lung cancer like them as well. Now, this was obviously before we understood. Well, that was obviously before the time of greater health awareness and understanding truly the importance of equality among the sexes. Today, the best way not to sell anything to women is to call them baby. But let me suggest that the phrase, as originally coined, can be a good description of what God has done in our lives. It can remind us of just how far God has brought us in bringing us to himself and to a very special calling and position. It can also remind us that because of what Yeshua has done, there is equality in his sight between Jewish people and Gentiles, and there can be real unity. This is what Rav Shaul was talking about in Ephesians chapter 2, the second part of the chapter. And if you pay careful attention to the text or listened attentively as it was read, he used the imagery of the temple to explain his point. You see, it really was a long way from outside the temple courtyard to inside the temple. And the way inside illustrated the differences that existed between people in their approach to God. Outside the whole temple complex, then there's the court of the Gentiles, then there's a fence, then there's a court of the women, there's a court of Israel, there's a court of the priests, there's the holy place, there's the most holy place. And what he is saying effectively here is, because of Yeshua, God brought us a long way, all the way inside. So we begin, and you see it in your outline that's on the flip side of the reading for tonight. We begin on the outside, looking in. Rav Shaul asked them to recall what they had been and how far they had come. In other words, to reflect on their previous condition. He describes them as Gentiles. He describes them as uncircumcised in contrast to those who were circumcised. Now, some translations at this point talk in terms of the so-called circumcision. That's not really a good translation. Far better would be, as you have it here, those who are called circumcision. In other words, this is a simple reference to Jews and Gentiles. Now, as some translations have it, they refer to body or flesh or the hands of men, or by birth. In other words, what he's talking about here are physical distinctions. In other words, that which is external, not that which is innate. Nevertheless, in all honesty, in this context and in their context and reality, this stuff yielded some very real distinctions with significant consequences. In verse 12, so what did it mean to be uncircumcised at that time? In other words, what are the consequences? Please remember, going all the way back to Genesis chapter 17, circumcision is the sign of a covenant relationship with God. Therefore, being uncircumcised means someone who's outside of the covenant relationship with God. And so you have these drastic descriptions. Separate, totally apart from the Messiah. Excluded or estranged from the commonwealth, the community of Israel and citizenship in Israel. In other words, that which reflected life with God. They were also foreigners to or outside the covenants of promise. That means the covenants, remember, had to do with blessing. They had to do with wholeness. And then the text says, the rabbi tells us, without hope and without God. Now there's a real dead end, friends. Without hope and without God. To have a relationship with God, please understand in that context, you must be part of the covenant. Without God, quite clearly in reality, is truly without hope. He describes those who were far away in verse 13 and those who are near. He describes those who were far away, and now he describes them as having been brought near. Now, that's a real contrast. But notice how it takes place. It takes place in, or actually in union with, Yeshua. Now, we talked about some of that stuff last week, and on reflecting on it, I didn't elaborate on it as well as I would like to, so I may get back to it again sometime, but not tonight. So I warn you of that. There may be a rerun of last week's Drash somewhere down the road. But it's in union with Yeshua the Messiah and all that implies, and it has taken place through or by his blood. Now look, I'm going to get in trouble here. So I'm going to take a step aside so that no one can recognize me. In some translations and by some people, there's been a lot of emphasis that translation didn't mention his blood. Think with me for a second. Was it his blood that secured our relationship with God or his death? Which the blood reflected. Obviously his death. Had he bled all he wanted and not died, we wouldn't be here. Fair enough? Okay, so in case you hear that, don't slaughter the person saying it and shed their blood. But understand that he's talking about Yeshua's death. He's talking about the sacrifice that took place. There was truly an exchange of life. Yeshua exchanged his life for our lives, which were forfeit. That's the basic principle of atonement. Now, please understand that the covenants, all of them, were sealed and ratified this way. By sacrifice, as part of it. So when he's talking in this fashion, the rabbi is indicating that because this happened, we are now part of the covenant. Quick. Important observation. This does not mean, as some people think, that believing Gentiles become Jewish people. Because in this text, the grammar is structured in such a way that verse 11 clearly describes them as still Gentiles. And in case you missed it here, he begins the next chapter calling them Gentiles. And in the opening paragraph does so twice. And he talks about Gentiles as now being, as Gentiles, heirs together with Israel. So what? Well, reflect on this question, please. How far has God brought us? Well, the next paragraph or next clump of verses gives us an idea. As we see that the walls come tumbling down, he talks about people, and he talks about peace between people, and he talks about accord. I don't mean one of those things that Gary played earlier, and stick with me, Gary. He talks about accord. He talks about making two into one. Now, all kinds of translations here at this particular point. New American Standard Bible is very deliberate in the way it is translated, and that may be helpful at this point. He's talking about the barrier of the dividing wall. Now, what's he talking about when he speaks in that way? He's talking about the intervening wall or fence that formed a barrier. In other words, what we have here is imagery of the temple courtyard situation. He's talking about the fence that separated Gentiles from Jewish people. Look, it allowed them to come into the temple area and they could offer sacrifices, but they could go no further unless they became Jewish people. This, by the way, was a significant part of the context of the discussion that produced Acts 15, namely the role of Gentiles with respect to the Messianic Jewish faith. Now, anyhow, that kind of differentiation produced, as the text says, enmity or hostility or tension. It produced separation or alienation instead of accord or peace. I know, try to pay attention this way rather than that way. Now, verse 15. Separation, as represented by the fence, separation is broken down. That which had kept the Gentiles at a distance from the Jewish people and from God is broken down. The partition wall is gone, so to speak. Gentiles could now approach God without becoming Jews. And that is, in fact, what Acts 15 concluded. Now, I want you to understand this very clearly, so take careful note. The Jewish people had not lost anything in this process. We got new brothers and sisters, reflecting on something that the psalmist had said, as God promised Psalm 2, the heathen will be part of your inheritance. And what he's saying here is that the two became one family. And so there was peace. There was accord. Now, some translations at this point talk about having abolished the law of commandments and regulations. It's not in this translation, but because others have it, let me at least reflect on that quickly. Abolished the law of commandments and regulations. He abolished the law? Well, that would contradict what Yeshua himself said in Matthew chapter 5. It would also contradict what the rabbi had said in another letter he wrote in Romans chapter 3. He asked, do we abolish the law? And he says, in no way. And if Yeshua said that's not what was going on, and Rav Shaul said that's not what was going on, here's a thought. If it was good enough for Jesus and Paul, it's good enough for me. Fair enough? The structure of the phrase indicates that what the rabbi is doing is he's consciously, specifically limiting this phrase to a precise focus. Not the fence itself, but what that fence represents. Abolishing in his flesh, the New American Standard Bible puts very clearly, the enmity or the alienation, not the law, not the Torah. And so we read in our translation, for he is our shalom. He united both groups into one people and figuratively broke down the barrier separating them. He did this by abolishing their hostility to each other. This was illustrated by certain temple rules and regulations. He did this in order to create union within himself to make one new community out of the two. This brought about shalom. Therefore, the two have become, and this is a hyphenated phrase I put together, the two have become a worshiping together family. All right? With no separating fence in between. Peace, unity, accord. The hostility, not the law. The hostility is now dead and gone. And as verse 16 notes, his purpose was to reconcile both groups into one family of God, since he ended that hostility by his death. Please note that not only Gentiles, but also Jews had to be reconciled or brought back to God, or brought closer to God. And this took Yeshua's death to accomplish. And so, we all have access, verses 17 and 18. Far away and near, by the way, describe the temple imagery. Who were the people who were near? Those who were in the court of Israel. Who were the people who were far away? Those who were only in the court of the Gentiles. The prophets speak in similar fashion, those near and those far. he's reinforcing and summarizing the previous couple of verses. By the way, this is a quotation, in case you missed it. Like other rabbis of his day, he combines Isaiah 57 and Isaiah 52 to put together this particular affirmation or description. And what's the result of all this? Well, both now have access. Both now have access. In other words, there are no walls, no partitions, no fences. It's unhindered entry to God. Hebrews 9 and 10 describes it as well. Please note something else in this text, that Yeshua, the Father, and the Ruach HaShem, the Spirit of God, all play a part in this process. As we already saw several weeks ago in Ephesians chapter 1. So what? What's the big deal? Well, the big deal is this. We've got accord. We've got unity. We've got access, unhindered access to the God of the universe. That's a pretty big deal. But we need to take note, as the outline indicates in verses 19 to 22, that there's more. The walls go back up. The walls go back up? What's going on here? What's the conclusion? Well, verse 19. Notice the stark contrast. You've got foreigners or immigrants. If you're a foreigner or an immigrant, basically you have no rights, no relationship. But now you've become fellow citizens with God's people. You share the rights and privileges, the blessings, oh yes, and as Matt indicated, the responsibilities as well. And you've become, we've all become God's household. Now this is even more intimate. Not just God's people, but God's family. We live not only on the grounds, but in the house. That's some conclusion. Now he changes the metaphor. Actually, it's a wordplay on household, which is the literal translation here. Household. House. Never mind. In other words, we are like a building. And so he talks now about construction. And he talks about the cornerstone. Look, just so you know, the cornerstone is not that right angle stone in the corner. I know it sounds like that, but that's not what it was then. It was a long slab, often 15 feet long, along the base of a building. It is, in fact, messianic imagery as well. So it's much like a foundation stone. You will remember Psalm 118, verse 22. You'd better, because adversely every holiday we read from Psalm 118. The stone that the builders chose not to use has become the chief cornerstone. It's the foundation stone. This is the Lord's doing. It's marvelous in our eyes. It's messianic imagery. And not only are we talking about a building, verse 21 tells us it's a special kind of building. And here he returns to the temple imagery of earlier. He says, you are a holy temple. You are a sacred sanctuary. Friends, what's a sanctuary? What we're all sitting in? No. In those days, the sanctuary is where God actually was present. Don't miss that. That should affect our lives. That should affect our perspectives and our performance. That should alter our attitudes, actions, and activities. Please take note that the text says very clearly, it's growing, it's rising. In other words, this is not a complete building. It is, in fact, in process. And depending on the translation, he talks about being joined together or fitted together or built together. It indicates, once again, unity, close relationship, or how about this, a good fit. Each has his or her specific, important, significant place or purpose in this building. Verse 22 tells us something of the implications of being God's temple. It's real simple at one level, but amazing at another. God lives in us. Leviticus 26 reinforced that when God described himself as, I'll walk along the paths between your tents. Or Exodus 40, which describes when he actually moved into the neighborhood. And notice here in this text, verse 22, that the activator is the Ruach HaShem, the Spirit of God. God lives in us. Now that's some pinnacle. Remember, we are the pinnacle of his plan and purpose. We've described that for several weeks. Or actually, the rabbis described it for several weeks. Now let me change that. It didn't take him several weeks to write this letter. It's not that long. But it's taken us several weeks to work through it. This is some pinnacle inhabited by the God of the universe. God has brought us a long way. As far as God was concerned, the people to whom the rabbi was writing were on the outside looking in, about as far away from God as possible, cut off from his promises and activity, with no relationship to the very source of life, the God of the universe. But God, through Yeshua, brought them to himself and made him his family. And this is what he's done for us also. And beyond all that, he's brought together two peoples that seemed impossible to get together because of their radically different cultures and outlooks, Jews and Gentiles. Through Yeshua, he's broken down the walls and the barriers. He's made them all part of the same family, his own family. And in so doing, he's made possible what so many people have dreamed of, the unity and familyhood of humankind. And we get to live that out in our own congregation and community. And if that were not enough, he has given us a very special place, a high calling, a lofty position. We are his holy temple. We are his sacred sanctuary. We are his home, the place he lives. And if you thought the description in tonight's parsha was amazing, read the one that closes Exodus when God moves into the neighborhood, Exodus 40, 34 to 38. Now, he wants us to grow. He wants us to assume our responsibilities as his people to live as those inhabited by God. He also wants us to realize and, in fact, experience how special we each are to him and therefore how important we are to each other because we're a good fit. We are the temple and the dwelling place of the God of the universe. Look, friends, that should produce significance to our activities and should provide purpose for our lives. As the text says, the rabbi points out, we've come an awfully long way. So I leave you with this question. So when others watch us, can they tell? That's your call, your chance to respond. Do so in quiet for the next several moments.